On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. The controversy over the practice of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. There are some who believe that if it's allowed in Western Maryland, it could generate up to 3,000 jobs and at least $5 million in annual tax revenues. But concerns abound about the impact on the environment and public health. We'll hear from Dr. David Vanko, the former head of the Maryland Fracking Commission, and Nathan Sterner talks to Dr. Brian Schwartz, a researcher from Johns Hopkins, and Senator Bobby Zirkin, who has proposed banning the practice. What's the future of fracking in Maryland? And Alan Walden is the Republican candidate for mayor of Baltimore. He joins me to talk about his vision for the future of Charm City. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of the new show at the Ford's Theater in Washington, Come From Away. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. We begin today's show with a look at the controversial issue of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. It's a method of getting at natural gas that involves injecting millions of gallons of water, sand, and chemicals into the ground at high pressures to fracture the underlying rock so the gas can come out. Fracking has expanded rapidly across the U.S. in the past few years. Much of that's been in the western states, but there are also thousands of fracking operations in the east, in the area known as the Marcellus Shale. That's a rock formation that runs beneath Maryland's two westernmost counties. Back when he was governor, Democrat Martin O'Malley established a review panel to examine the potential environmental and health impacts of fracking, as well as its potential economic benefits. The commission recommended that fracking be allowed to move forward, but with caution and with rigorous regulation. Then, Republican Larry Hogan was elected governor, and shortly after he took office, the General Assembly got involved, passing a 2-year moratorium on fracking, which Hogan decided not to veto. That moratorium is set to end next year. Dr. David Vanko was the chair of the so-called fracking commission that made the initial cost-benefit review. In a conversation with Maryland Morning producer Rob Sivak, Vanko said he believes the commission's pro-fracking recommendation struck a reasonable balance.
We felt that given all the factors that we were trying to balance, that we came up with the strongest possible set of best practices and monitoring recommendations and regulation recommendations and financial assurance recommendations that all taken together would allow the state to do this with minimal risk, but not no risk. Nobody is trying to suggest that.
Vanko said the final report from Maryland's Environment Department did not rule out the prospect that new information about fracking might be factored into drilling regulations due out next month. But he cautioned that some of the department's draft regulations appear to be weakening the state's regulatory control.
My personal inclination is to say that if MDE proposes new regulations that are significantly weakened, like these appear to be, that's only going to lend weight to the argument that we're not ready to do this without taking on more risk than we should.
That's former Fracking Commission Chair Dr. David Vanko, Dean of the Fisher College of Science and Mathematics at Towson University, speaking last week with senior producer Rob Sivak. Maryland's Environment Department may see fracking as somewhat safe, but public doubts have been stoked by a steady stream of troubling scientific research. Dr. Brian Schwartz, a professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School Department of Environmental Health, has co-authored a series of 4 papers over the past year that suggest fracking operations could be the culprit in a wide range of health and environmental problems. Dr. Schwartz joins me in the studio to discuss these findings. Good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us on the phone is State Senator Bobby Zirkin, who first proposed a permanent ban on fracking in Maryland back in 2014 and plans to do so again in Annapolis next year. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Senator Zirkin, let me first hear your thoughts on Dr. Vanko's concern that the state's new proposed fracking regulations appear weaker than the ones it put forth back in 2015.
I agree with that assessment, but, I think in some way, there are some areas the new regulations are slightly stronger, and in some ways, in more ways, they're slightly weaker. I think that avoids the bigger topic, which is that there's no amount of regulations at this point in time that can protect the public from the potential public health and environmental issues. The fact that the fracking industry was fine with the regulations is really all you need to know.
Let me note that not all industry groups said they were okay with the regulations. The Maryland Petroleum Council said they are still the toughest in the country, but you're saying that no amount of toughness is tough enough.
Well, I mean, look, I could give you some examples of things that they did not address if we were to go down this path. It's not a safe technology right now, and, you know, as Dr. Banco said, he talked about the risk. When there is that much risk to people's lives, it's not something you mess around with.
Back when the fracking moratorium was approved, lawmakers had been hoping that it would allow some time for scientists to study fracking's impacts. And Dr. Schwartz, you and your colleagues have been doing just that. Walk us through the studies that you have conducted.
So in the last year and a half or so, we have published four separate studies. The first paper was looking at our metric of where the wells were and their size and their location in relation to building radon levels, because there's concern that radon is present in the shale layer and in the natural gas itself. Our second paper was on birth outcomes, and we looked specifically at preterm birth and high-risk pregnancy and low birth weight. The third study was on asthma exacerbations. We looked at three separate kinds of asthma exacerbations, and the fourth study was on a variety of symptoms.
And in all of these cases, you found associations between fracking and radon in buildings, bad birth outcomes, asthma symptoms like migraines and fatigue.
So just to clarify, the symptom study is based on a questionnaire that we received back from 8,000 people. The birth outcome and asthma studies are based on Geisinger's electronic health records. So they have electronic health records on these hundreds of thousands of patients that go back to 2001, and we looked at them from 2005 to 2012, and we identified 35,000 asthma patients, and we used electronic health records to identify who was hospitalized for asthma, who went to the emergency department for asthma, and who had a new medication order for a mild exacerbation. So those three kinds are called severe, moderate, and mild exacerbation. So it's actually not based on symptoms. It's actually based on hard outcomes, like who ended up in the hospital or who had such severe coughing and shortness of breath and wheezing, which is what happens in an asthma exacerbation, that they actually went to the emergency department or called their doctor for a new medication. And we found that, yes, unconventional natural gas development was associated with all three kinds of exacerbations.
Now, your studies were conducted in Pennsylvania, where there are some 10,000 fracking operations, 10,000 wells. Maryland's projected to have maybe 100 fracking sites should fracking get off the ground. Do you think the results you saw in fracking-intensive Pennsylvania would be repeated here?
It's hard to know exactly. The way we count up, the way we assign an unconventional natural gas development activity metric to the person's residence is based on the number and the distance of the wells. So I think if you're close to a single well or farther away from dozens of wells, they can have the same effect. That's what our data would show.
Now that we don't have a fracking commission anymore, now that it's been disbanded, what impact do you think your findings can have on fracking policy?
Well, it's interesting to me that, you know, New York, looking at health considerations, decided to not allow this process years ago, and Maryland did the moratorium. And this was before any of our health studies had come out. Now that the health studies are out, I think that they provide the information that was lacking before. And if they came to that conclusion before the health studies, I'm not sure that the presence of the health studies would reassure them that their prior decisions were not correct.
And Senator Zirkin, will you be using these health studies in the next General Assembly session as you push for a ban on fracking in Maryland?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I actually was just, before coming on your show, was reading one of these studies about sinus, migraine, headache, and fatigue symptoms that Dr. Schwartz had done. And of course, I mean, you get individuals down in Annapolis who will deny and say there's been no hard correlation between the health effects and fracking. But, you know, I'm not a scientist and I'm not a researcher. That's why we get experts like Dr. Schwartz to come down and testify on these bills. You know, the point that I've tried to raise with the folks who say that is that there is clearly, I mean, at best you can say that there's a lot of smoke around this in terms of public health outcomes. And so I don't know why we would even consider risking people's health and lives out in Western Maryland when there is this much smoke around there. But of course, these studies have been are very big in terms of hopefully affecting the public policy. You know, there have been other studies that we've seen from around the country that show similar things. It's good to have this coming from our own Johns Hopkins University. So the oil and gas lobby is exceptionally strong, and it's unfortunate because they have power far disproportionate to what they should.
In addition to the oil and gas lobby, though, Senator Zirkin, you'll also be facing economic headwinds. It's estimated that fracking in Maryland could create some 3,000 jobs and maybe $5 million in tax revenue a year.
Let me dispel that. That actually cuts both ways. There are, not the Facebook and social media is the be-all and end-all, but if you do go on there, there are an extraordinary number of folks from up in Western Maryland who would disagree with that economic assessment, folks who are involved in the tourist industry, folks that are around, you know, the Deep Creek Lake area. I mean, there are towns up there that have already moved on their own to ban this. So the idea that somehow this is a boon to Western Maryland, I think, is highly debatable. There are certainly towns, when you look at what's going on around the rest of the country, there is certainly a short-term economic benefit that I would argue in many cases is far outweighed by the long-term economic downturn that you see when things go south. And the tourism industry up there, which is, you know, employs a lot of folks, they certainly would not agree with the assessment that this is good for the economy. Also, when you see, I mean, up in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, I mean, you see lots of folks who are coming in from out of state, so I would argue this is not necessarily jobs that are going to Marylanders, even if you would agree with the fact that these are jobs that are going to be created. There's certainly nothing to say that these are Maryland jobs. But there are towns that looked real good from the onset in terms of economic development when fracking started that don't look so good now that a couple of years down the road. So when you factor in the double-edged sword of the economic analysis with the clear issues of public health and environmental risk, I think that this is a no-brainer.
What do you think the prospects are for getting a ban passed?
That is a different question. Whether it's an intellectual no-brainer or not doesn't necessarily mean that it carries the day in politics, as we all unfortunately know. I don't know how to handicap that. I can only go down there and do the best I can. But at the end of the day, this is going to require public pressure and for citizens to get up and make sure that their representatives are voting the way that they think they should on this issue, and it's an important one.
Fracking will certainly be a major issue in the upcoming General Assembly session. State Senator Bobby Zirkin has represented Baltimore County in the General Assembly since 2007. Dr. Brian Schwartz is a professor of environmental health sciences at the Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School and co-author of a series of recent studies on possible adverse health effects from hydraulic fracturing operations. Thank you both for joining me.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for having us.
More information online at WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, Alan Walden, Republican nominee for mayor of Baltimore, joins Tom Hall in studio to explain what kind of leadership he hopes to bring to this city. This is Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And thank you, Nathan. It is Maryland Morning. This morning, we continue our conversations with candidates for mayor of Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Republican Alan Walden joins me in the studio. He will be one of three candidates on the ballot in November, along with Democratic nominee Senator Catherine Pugh and Green Party candidate Joshua Harris. Alan Walden was a morning anchor and commentator at WBAL Radio for 16 years. For 15 years before that, he was chief radio correspondent for NBC News Worldwide. He is 80 years old. He lives in Baltimore's Cross Keys with his wife, Jeannie. They are the parents of two grown children, a Brooklyn native. He is, he says, a Baltimorean by choice, having lived in the city since 1988. Alan Walden, it is terrific to see you. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, and it's good to see you again since the last time we got together doing something entirely different.
Very different. We were selling auction items for Center Stage or something. Well, as you used to say on WBAL, we have a lot to talk about.
Oh, boy.
So first, let's talk about how you're doing. You look terrific, but this summer you received a very serious diagnosis and you underwent surgery for cancer. But how you feeling?
I feel fine. I recovered from it pretty well. I'm not 100% back to where I should be, but probably 95%+. It was very frightening. The word cancer itself is terribly frightening. And now I join the legions of cancer survivors. I'm fine. I'm clean.
Terrific. Well, I'm one of those as well, and I'm glad to have you join the club. You have been on my side of the mic many hundreds, thousands of times. I wonder, what do you think voters should be asking in this election? How do you think voters should be framing the questions about the city of Baltimore and our future?
Well, I'll frame it the way I have framed it. Do you think that the same people doing the same things in the same way can produce a different outcome? And the answer, I think, is no. And I think that's the question that voters should be asking. What have we gotten? Where are we after decades of one-party rule? There hasn't been a Republican mayor in Baltimore since Theodore Roosevelt McKeldin. And I don't think there's been a Republican on the city council since before World War II. It's been that long. That doesn't mean that we are living under the tyranny of a single party. It just means that's the way things have evolved. And I don't think they have evolved well. And I'm assumption being a very dangerous thing to do, but I'm going to assume that a lot of the people who live here, 622,000 people, we once had a population of almost 1 million, but that was a long time ago, that the voters of Baltimore are saying, wait, something is really fundamentally wrong here, and we ought to try something new.
What would be new in an Alan Walden administration that we haven't seen, for example, in a Stephanie Rawlings-Blake administration, or that we might expect to see in a Catherine Pugh administration?
Okay, the first thing is, a different identity, a different definition of the city of Baltimore. That's the right word, definition. We spend a lot of our time talking about what's wrong, what needs fixing, and a lot of things do. They have to be fixed. But we don't spend any time, or not nearly enough time, talking about what there is about the city that makes it quite extraordinary. One of the reasons I came here in the first place is it is an extraordinary place. It has gifts, wonderful attractions, magnificent historical heritage, and we don't talk about that. We don't talk about the Inner Harbor anymore, which we should. We don't talk about the Star-Spangled Banner anymore and Fort McHenry and the National Aquarium and the things that can attract people to the city of Baltimore. I am a cheerleader. This town needs a cheerleader, somebody to go out and tell people, this is what's good about Baltimore, come here, and we'll prove it to you. At the same time, as we deal with the issues that must be discussed and the problems that have to be solved, and there are plenty of them. Also, there's the idea of government itself. Constitutional conservative, which is the way I describe myself. The government doesn't do everything, and it shouldn't. The government should provide an atmosphere and an environment in which things happen. Encourage them to happen, but don't get too involved in them so that people cannot function easily within that environment.
Well, tell us what then the parameters of that involvement should be. Let's take, as a case in point, Port Covington. Luke Broadwater reporting in the Baltimore Sun this morning that it looks like there's enough people on the city council who have signed a petition that will force this vote out of committee to a full vote by the council, and it would putatively head to Mayor Rawlings Blake's desk pretty soon. What's your feeling about that deal as you know it, as you understand it at this point, and is that a legitimate and good use of whatever leverage government might have when it comes to something like this?
The TIF is a crapshoot. The payoff comes down the road. The thing about Port Covington is like the thing about the Inner Harbor. You can compare the development of the two. Port Covington is on the water. we love to develop on the water. We don't love to develop away from the water that much, but on the water. The land was available. Kevin Plank has a proven record of being successful in what he does. This is a $500 million project. He's put a lot of his own money into it. He's going to put in more. People like Kevin
Plank. Well, the total project's about $5.5 billion. Yeah. But the city's TIF part is about $660 million.
Yeah, a little more than
the largest one of those that has ever come down.
Absolutely.
The pipe.
But there's no reason to believe that it won't be successful. There's no reason to believe that it won't be good for Baltimore. Now, there have been negotiations along the way about jobs, about low-cost housing. Adjustments have been made. But we can't nitpick this deal to death to the point where even someone like Kevin, I don't know the man personally, so forgive me, Mr. Plank, for calling you Kevin. He has made a commitment to invest in the city of Baltimore. He's our number one entrepreneur right now. Let him do what he does best, because down the road it will augur well for the development of new industry, new housing, and a new look for Baltimore City. I am in favor of the TIF.
But is it unreasonable for the city to say, okay, Mr. Plank, you want to develop what amounts to a city within a city? We will build all of these roads. We will put in these stop signs. We will put in the sidewalks. We will put in the gas and sewer lines and that sort of thing. We will do all of the infrastructure that you need so that you can build your headquarters, so that you can develop retail establishments, you can build housing. And in return, we'd like you to make sure that, number one, the people you hire to some degree are going to live in the city of Baltimore, and that, number two, it will not be the housing that will be available will not just be for people of means. It will be for people who are economically disadvantaged, who are not making a whole lot of money. Is it unreasonable for the government to say, since we're going to take the risk by creating all this infrastructure, we need to get something in return?
No, it's not unreasonable, but it's not the government, it's the people. The government is the people. That's the nice thing about the United States, to ask that question. Yes, there should be jobs, and a substantial number of them, for Baltimoreans. The problem is, can you find the people in the city to do the jobs that need to be done? There was a recent survey, I think it was last week, by the Department of Labor, that showed that there were 200,000 empty construction jobs in the United States because we can't find the skilled workers to fill them. You need people who can do more than just pick up a shovel and dig some dirt. You need the carpenters, electricians, the specialists.
But, of course, part of this deal includes a $25 million job training center, which will do just that.
Job training center is a great idea, too. But we should have young people coming out of our school system, the Baltimore City school system, who already have the skills. That's why I've made public education number one, my number one priority in this campaign. We have a terrible public school system in the city of Baltimore. $1.2 billion budget. Where does the money go? And why are we ranked lowest among the major urban school districts in the United States? We don't teach our young people the right things. We don't teach them how to work.
How does the mayor of Baltimore influence what happens in the school system? What can you do as the mayor to change what's going on in the instructional life of these teachers and students?
Unfortunately, the mayor cannot simply stand up and say, okay, the school system is now going to be changed. I have to work with the state to do that. We have ceded a lot of the authority in the city to the state over the years, probably a mistake. But the pure and simple fact is, if you can convince the state, the legislature, the legislators, that something has to be done, that half of our schools should be vocational technical schools, that young people should come out of high school with the skills to immediately enter the workforce, whether or not they want to go to college. That's their choice. It can be done. You have to have somebody at the helm in the mayor's office who is willing to fight this fight and fight it to win it.
So you want to wrest control of the school system back from the state to the city?
Absolutely.
And what does that accomplish exactly? Because that costs money.
It will. There's no doubt that it will cost money, but I think it's defeatist to assume that if we take control, we meaning the city of Baltimore, of our schools again, that the state will simply wash its hands of the whole thing. We can still get aid from the state. I'm sure that Larry Hogan understands that we have to improve public education in the city of Baltimore. But if we have control of our own schools, we can change the matrix and turn out high school graduates who are more capable of contributing not only to their own lives, but to the health of the city as a whole.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Alan Walden. He is the Republican nominee for mayor of Baltimore City. Let's talk about the city and the problems of racial and economic inequality that were laid bare in April of 2015 when we had this terrible violence and uprising. And since then, people have been thinking about ways to attenuate what they call the two Baltimores, the Baltimoreans who are well off and those who are not so well off. Do you accept that characterization of two Baltimores?
I reject it entirely. I reject it because I think that we all have, all of the people who live in Baltimore, the same basic goals and objectives, the success of the city and the success of the people who live in it. Now, you talked about the riots that took place more than a year ago, back in April of 2015. Triggered by the Freddie Gray case. Everything started to unravel with that. The police department has now been marginalized to a great degree by the Justice Department report, by the consent decree to which people have agreed. Wait a minute.
They've not quite agreed to the consent decree yet, but they're working at it.
Okay. They're working on it. They will eventually agree on something, some framework for revising plans and objectives and training and what have you. But to marginalize the police, which is what we've done, has created a strange, call it backlash, within certain parts of the community. What is it? On the Labor Day weekend, we had 22 shootings, 3 deaths just over that one weekend. When you take the police and say, these people are bad, you actually empower the outlaw element because it says, well, nobody's going to pay attention to the cops anymore. We can do pretty much what we want. We have to bring together the good-hearted, good-spirited people on both sides, and I hate calling them both sides because we should all be together, in the law enforcement community and the general population and say, look, we all have the same goal and objective. We need a better city. We can build it together if we stop being angry at one another all the time. If we stop looking for reasons to be offended, if we trust one another, how can 22 people be shot over the weekend and no one see anything?
How does trust, though, when we talk about trusting each other, there are people in the African-American community who have very limited, if no trust at all, in the police department because, as the Department of Justice report outlined, there have been, you know, many, many documented cases of police misconduct and abuse of their authority. How do you regain the trust of the African-American community in the police department and in the criminal justice system, given the long history of what most folks described as, you know, as systemic racism and intolerance?
You're not going to create the proper environment overnight. You have to work on it. Nobody works on it better than the cop on the beat. You put the cops on the beat, and you do with them what we used to do with them years ago. They learn who lives in the neighborhood. They talk to the young people on the streets. They know the owners of the businesses. They create, through their demeanor and their presence on the beat, the sense of trust. They rebuild the sense of trust so that people, regardless of race, creed, color, or national origin, know or suspect or believe that if something goes wrong, if something looks wrong, I can go to this person and this person will do something to help me. It can be done. It takes work. People have to believe, and they have to be more reasonable in their approach.
Well, forgive me if I'm not getting this right, but okay. What you're saying doesn't, I think, makes a lot of sense to a lot of people, and it doesn't sound to me to be completely different, or as a matter of fact, different at all from what I've heard Senator Pugh say, or for that matter, all 13 folks who were running for the Democratic nomination back in April, and I talked to every one of them.
I don't think there's
no problem getting consensus about, you know, some of the things that the police should do, but is there a particular, because when you talk about, you know, the Democrats have been in control since the 1960s in the mayor's office. I mean, is there any radical departure you can point to in terms of policy that that people can identify?
Well, the one thing I'd like to do is I'd like very much to have a law enforcement summit in the city of Baltimore, because there are cities around the country with similar problems. Detroit is one, St. Louis is another one, New Orleans is another one, but also the cities where things have worked. What has worked? Safe streets sometimes works. The broken window policy works and then doesn't work. We've already decided pretty much that...
This broken window seems to be very much at odds with what you're talking about, community policing with the cops.
That's why I said sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. I don't think that zero tolerance works very well at all. We have to address the drug problem. We have to address the issue of gangs. Most of the activity that takes place about drug-related crime has to do with gangs. There are other shootings at random as well. I'm not saying that all of us or that many other candidates aren't thinking the same way that I am, but you have to be direct and quick and move on this swiftly instead of picking around the edges. And we've done a lot of picking around the edges.
We got 10 seconds left. You know what that means because you're an old radio hand. Are you going to vote for Donald Trump, sir?
Tough question. There are a lot of questions that are being asked about Donald Trump. We got Hillary's health, and we've got Donald Trump, whom I regard as a combination of P.T. Barnum and Theodore Roosevelt. How's that?
I'm not quite sure what to make of that. Well, it's good to see you, and good luck with the rest of the campaign, and I'm delighted to see that you're feeling well and looking terrific.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Alan Walden is the Republican nominee for mayor of Baltimore City. He'll go head-to-head on the ballot in November with Democrat Senator Catherine Pugh, Green Party nominee Joshua Harris. Programming note, Joshua Harris will join me here on Maryland Morning coming up on Friday. Coming up after a break for the news, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She'll have a review of Come From Away at the Ford's Theater in Washington. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Also with me here in the studio is our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Morning, Judy. How you doing?
Good morning, Tom. Fine, thank you.
So every Monday morning, we are joined by Judy, who gives us her thoughts on all things thespian. Today, Judy, we're going to talk about a show at the Ford's Theater in Washington. It's called Come From Away. Yesterday, of course, marked the 15th anniversary of 9/11. And as I understand it, Come From Away is a musical actually connected to that event. It seems incredible to have a musical about 9/11. It seems very unlikely. What's this all about?
Well, Tom, the word connected is the key here. It is very important to say that this is not a musical about the terrorist attacks. It's actually a musical about human kindness. What people may not know is that when U.S. airspace was closed shortly after those tragic events, many airplanes headed to the States were diverted to Canada. 38 jumbo jets landed in the small town of Gander, Newfoundland alone. And that experience is the basis of Come From Away. Come From Aways, Tom, is what the people of Newfoundland call out-of-towners. They're come from aways. And on 9/11, the number of out-of-towners 7,000, almost doubled the population of Little Gander, Newfoundland.
So here we have these stranded passengers, we have flight crews, we have this small town in Canada and all the locals. These folks, I mean, Newfoundland is a beautiful place. Does it make a great setting for a musical?
Well, in the hands of Irene Sankoff and David Hine, the Canadian husband and wife team who created this show, it does make the source of an excellent musical. The show has already had runs in La Jolla, California, and Seattle, Washington. It's headed to Broadway in February, and it is a remarkably hopeful, heartwarming story that comes out of great horror and loss. The Gander citizens opened their doors and opened their hearts. They cooked meals for these people. They let the passengers take showers in their homes. They gave them their own clothing. The passengers didn't have access to their luggage. The pharmacy filled their prescriptions at no cost. The local SPCA even took care of the pets that were left in the cargo holds. So, Tom, I'm going to skip ahead a bit and play a really powerful song that comes near the end of the musical. You'll hear the passengers' gratitude when, after 5 days stranded in Gander, they're flying back to the United States.
Oh, there's a kumbaya moment for you. That's terrific. So, now, how many days total were they there? That's the fifth day?
Almost a week, yeah.
A whole week. God bless them, the people in Newfoundland. So that's the cast of Come From Away. They're performing the tune Somewhere in the Middle of Nowhere. So one thing that strikes me, this is a show about 36 or so planes arriving in a small town. That sounds incredibly tricky to stage. I mean, how do you put that in a theater? Is this one of those shows? A lot of times, I guess, they do this with, like, projections and stuff. How do they pull that off?
Well, they don't do that in this case. This is a very low-tech show, and that's really part of its charm. There's a cast of 12. They play multiple roles. They're under the very nimble direction of Christopher Ashley. The actors are all on stage almost the entire time. The same actors play passengers and folks from Newfoundland and flight crews. For example, there's an actor named Chad Kimball who plays a passenger. He plays the leader of the Gander School Bus Drivers Union, which is on strike. He even makes a brief appearance as President George W. Bush. The set is by a fellow named Beowulf Borat, and wooden chairs are the primary element. When they're in rows and they're moving slowly on a turntable, you really feel like you're watching a plane move. There's an 8-member band also on stage. The score has a lot of Celtic flavor and instrumentation, very true to the sound in Newfoundland.
Yeah, the music of Newfoundland is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. But the way the show is cast and staged reflects the major theme of shared humanity. I mean, having the same actors play Gander's unexpected guests and their very gracious hosts shows how everyone faced this crisis together. In terms of passengers coming together, they weren't allowed to deplane for a prolonged period of time, and they didn't know the details of what had happened or even where they were, but they started to bond, and I brought a song the passengers sing while they're still on board, some of them for 28 hours.
Meanwhile, on our plane, we didn't have a clue. We were all going insane because
there wasn't squat to do.
Then the captain starts to apologize and says on behalf of the airline, I'm giving each and everyone's a
complimentary booze. We open the airplane doors, wave at all the cars, hello to wherever you are, wherever we are.
All right, that's 28 hours wherever we are for the musical Come From Away, and anybody who's ever been stuck on a tarmac knows what that feels like, although I doubt very few people have been stuck on a tarmac for 28 hours. So you mentioned that at this moment, the passengers weren't fully aware of why the planes were diverted. So they didn't know that the attacks had taken place in Manhattan and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. But we assume the flight crews presumably knew. I mean, how is their situation portrayed in this ordeal?
It's portrayed primarily through the character of a pilot named Beverly Bass. She was a trailblazing female commercial pilot for American Airlines, and she's in a very uncomfortable bind, but she always puts her responsibility to her passengers first. She's very strongly portrayed by Jen Colella, and she has a solo, Me and the Sky, about her lifelong love of flying and the obstacles she faced to become a female pilot. seemed like a dream come true to her until 9/11.
Suddenly I'm flying Paris to Dallas, across the Atlantic and feeling calm, when suddenly someone on air-to-air's traffic says at 8:46 there's been a terrorist action, and the one thing I loved more than anything was used as the bomb.
Hi, that's Jean Colella, and she's singing Me and the Sky from Come From Away. It's at the Ford's Theater. This show is being performed in Washington. It's headed to New York. Both cities, of course, suffered enormous losses on 9/11. Is this going to be difficult, a difficult sell in D.C. and New York, given what actually happened in those cities?
Well, you might think so, but I have two examples of why Washington and New York are actually a very good fit for this show. The audience member seated next to me the night I saw the show turned out to have been a first responder when the Pentagon was hit. And he told me that he was hesitant to see the show, but he ended up enormously moved. He got choked up talking to me. And there was a talk back the night that I went, and three of the real people portrayed on stage spoke. A couple who fell in love, met and fell in love when they were stranded in Newfoundland. They told me they've seen the show more than a dozen times. And the pilot, Beverly Bass. So it's not only acceptable to people directly affected, but it's truly uplifting. And I think it's going to be very welcome and very warmly received on Broadway.
Interesting. Come From Away. It's at Ford's Theater in Washington until October 9th. If you want to go, come to WIPR.org/Marilyn Morning. We'll shoot you a link to all the details. Thanks, Judy. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Looking ahead, folks, you may have heard that as of next week, my friend Sheila Cast and I are switching time slots. Beginning next Monday, Sheila will return to the mornings hosting a new show called On the Record, and I'll become the host of Midday. J. Wynn Russick will continue to do her reviews, which you'll now hear on Midday. So as of next week, Judy will share her thoughts on all things theater every Thursday afternoon here on WIPR. That's next week. This week, coming up Wednesday here on Marilyn Morning, the acclaimed journalist E.J. Dionne joins me to talk politics, and contributor Max Savage Levinson brings us a profile of the band Deerhoof. Hope you can join us Wednesday morning on Marilyn Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall for Nathan Sterner and the entire Marilyn Morning team. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac for our Muslim friends who are celebrating Eid al-Adha today. Eid Mubarak.